Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Life on the front lines requires you to step up your game. Owned and operated by former Navy SEAL Sean Mattson, CardoMax has designed just the right supplements for you and is offering Drinking Bros an exclusive offer. Buy one, get one free on your first order. Go to CardoMax.com and use the promo code DB. That's CardoMax.com, helping you achieve your max.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Drinking Bros. I am your fill-in host today, Rob Fox, and I am joined by Dan Holloway, as always. And we have a very special guest today. Author and documentary filmmaker, as well as police officer, David Usick. How you doing, David?
Good, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the story that you're kind of telling that we'll get into is pretty incredible, both from how you found it and what the actual story is. So happy to have you. And we have a lot of military and police and first responder listeners, so it's pretty cool. Story to have on for sure. I think it's awesome. And I won't hold the Marlins shirt against you. So
sorry about that. Used to be a Yankees fan.
Well, I feel like the Marlins are an upgrade, actually, socially speaking. So that's fine. And you always have a ticket. You can always get in the stadium.
Yeah. Yeah. There's not a whole lot of demand for tickets down there.
Always extra seating. Yeah. It's a good thing.
St. Pete. It's that's an old Marlins logo though, right? That's not the new one.
Yeah.
That's from like 2013 maybe?
Yeah, no, that's the one they won the World Series in.
Well, the two World Series.
Yeah.
With rental players.
Series, yeah.
The Marlins are kind of like the military contractor of the baseball world. Yeah, they just go out and get players for a year or two and then slide in there. Hey, it works.
Gary Sheffield had a good time there. It's fine.
So did Moises Alou and Bobby Bonilla and Kevin Brown and et cetera, et cetera.
The list goes on.
We're obviously baseball fans. I don't know if you could tell.
Yeah, we do a baseball show on Thursdays. Pudge, too. Pudge was on the 03 team.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, man, that's just a list of dudes. You're based out of Miami, correct?
Yeah, I'm originally from New York, and I moved down here about 30 years ago and just finished up my police career after 20 years.
Wow, that's a really unique story, moving from New York to Miami. I don't know if I've ever heard somebody doing that before.
Not at that age.
I'm the first guy.
Yeah, you're definitely the first.
I mean, you know, usually you're a lot grayer when you get the move down.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, that's true. But, get the jump on things. Miami's nice, actually. I'll be there tomorrow. We're going to the Mayweather fight tomorrow. I call it the Mayweather fight because he's the only person that's involved in any of the stuff that I've ever heard of. Except for Chad Ochocinco is apparently also fighting. What the fuck is going on?
It's just a clown show. Have you heard about these fights?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. The audience wants it. People are buying tickets. So, you know, let Mayweather make his money.
Yeah, right.
The guy paid his dues as a boxer, and these are all little freak shows where he can make some money for himself and not get brain damage. I mean, he's one of the few boxers that doesn't have brain damage, and that's because he's one of the best defensive fighters, you know, to ever be in the game.
Yeah, I do.
He's the best defensive fighter of all time, right? You got to say. Yeah. I mean, I don't know who else would even be in the same ballpark as him. Like, who else has specifically focused on defense?
I would say Bernard Hopkins.
True.
If you want to look at longevity and a guy who's, you know, not taking much head trauma,
right?
He's in the same boat.
But Mayweather acts like he may have taken a lot of head trauma, regardless of whether he has or not, right?
One of my favorite things on the internet is 50 Cent challenging Floyd Mayweather to read. Just constantly.
That's what this should be. It should be a fucking spelling contest, like what Doc Holliday wanted back in the day, right? And Tombstone, how about a spelling contest? That's what we should be seeing right now. But, you know, life is imperfect, so
yeah, it's fine.
We're going to have to fight.
I would definitely watch that, too. So, David, you have a pretty interesting story and are telling, on top of that, an interesting story. You first made the documentary, The Giant Killer, correct, about Richard Flaherty?
Yeah, initially, I just made the documentary. It was my hope at the time that's kind of that chapter in my life ends. And then so many people reached out to me after the documentary because there were so many mysterious things that I wasn't able to solve that I kind of felt compelled to put it all in a book, you know, put the missing pieces.
So for the audience who doesn't know, explain a little bit about kind of the background on this guy, Richard Flaherty, who I believe you met while you were a police officer and he was homeless, correct?
Yeah. So I worked in a small jurisdiction in Miami, the northern section of Miami called Aventura. And basically what happened was Miami broke up into different jurisdictions because everybody wanted their own little police force for their own unique needs. So my department was 120 men, about 5 square miles. And when I first started working there, I would run into this tiny little guy. I used to see him at the movie theater. When I say tiny, I mean, he was 4'9", about 90 pounds. But he kind of stuck out because he walked with a presence of confidence. And you can tell there was something a little bit different about the guy. And we would just start to say hello every once in a while because I just kept running into him so much in the city. And eventually, you know, we'd talk about what movie did you just go see, because I'd run into him a lot at the movie theater when I worked my off-duty job there. And that's how a friendship started. And we were friends for 15 years. Now, maybe a year or two into it, because I was, you know, initially I thought, you know, is this guy homeless? Why is he at the movie theaters for 8 hours? When I started seeing him on the streets and, you know, sitting on bus benches, it was pretty obvious that he was homeless, although he was very clean and he took care of his appearance. So, you know, at that point in time, I tried to get him some help and see if I get him off the streets. And he was reluctant, but he said, you know, he really appreciated it. And I kind of read it that he didn't want me pushing him anymore about it. So he looked like he was well taken care of. He didn't look like he was a danger to himself or anyone else. So I didn't push him.
I actually, there's a thing on your YouTube, that, you know, clips of the documentary and stuff. And one of the people you interviewed said, like, if he was homeless, he probably chose to be homeless.
You know, that's the biggest question I get is, you know, was he homeless by choice, or was he homeless because he suffered from PTSD and mental illness? I'm going to say it's a little bit of both. Because, yeah, he had opportunities, you know, at the end of his life to live in apartments. And even he had enough of a little pension to have a pretty crappy little apartment, you know, where he could pay for it on his own. But, you know, he didn't get the help he needed early on. And I think it was just way too late for him, I think... You know, he claims it was by choice, but I don't think it was. I just think there was just too much damage that he couldn't, you know, he couldn't live indoors.
I took that as, when I heard that, I had kind of taken it as part of like, he was just a very determined and self-determined person.
Well, I mean, it's from the perspective of the military, particularly special operations community, you get taught a lot of things. And the expectation is, particularly on a small ODA, you're going to be self-reliant. The one thing that has never been taught to veterans from any country that are veterans of any war is how to take care of yourself afterwards, right? How to ask for help, especially. for whatever reason, it's been categorized as weakness to ask for help, which is kind of stupid. I mean, it wouldn't be embarrassing for you to wreck your car and send it to a body shop to get it fixed.
Right.
Because not only do I not have time for that, I have no idea what the fuck I'm doing. But for some reason, when transitioning in and out of fucking traumatic situations, it is the expectation that we put on ourselves is that this is my burden to bear and I don't want to saddle anybody else with it. That's a really stupid way to go through life, by the way. But it is what it is. We all do it. So I'm sure that's what it is. It's not that he doesn't. I agree with you. I don't know the man. You knew him for 14 years. I didn't know him. But just from my personal experience, I would say that probably what you're saying is accurate, that he definitely needed help but refused to ask for it, which is the case for a lot of us, frankly.
And the PTSD you're talking about, this guy, Richard Flaherty, who you met on the street and in the movie theater and stuff, he was a Vietnam veteran.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, he wasn't telling me really much about himself. And that was okay with me because, you know, he would talk to me about other things, about world politics, and we'd make some jokes. And so it was enjoyable to spend time with him. The guy was really intelligent. And it wasn't until after 15 years of friendship that he dropped the bomb on me one day while we were having lunch. And he said, you know, it's time I tell you who I really am. Now, as a cop, you're like, oh, shit, what is he about to, you know, like, holy fuck, what is he going to tell me? He's a serial killer. He knows this. Like, well, you know, I kind of had a, you know, good respect for the guy at that point in time. I was a little nervous about what he was going to say. And, you know, he said to me something that I thought was outlandish at the time. He said, hey, I was in the military. I was the smallest man ever serve. And I went to Vietnam and eventually went to Special Forces school and got my Green Beret. I was awarded the Silver Star, 2 Bronze Stars, 2 Purple Hearts. And, you know, like I said, I just initially, I'm not a military guy. I've just been a police officer my whole life, but I've never heard of somebody 4'9" in the military. And certainly he would never become a Green Beret. And how is it possible for him to even do those things? So I felt really bad. I was like, you know, I didn't know my friend was that delusional. You know, I thought he had a little bit better grasp on reality. That night when I went home, I almost didn't look up his story on Google and check his name because it just didn't seem possible. But I did. And that's when I saw some stories about him entering the military. And, you know, they always do that picture with the shortest guy with the tallest guy. I've seen lots of that over the years. So they did that, obviously, a couple times with Richard and taller guys. So there was a little bit of a trail to follow. So, you know, I went back to Richard the next day when I ran into him, and I was like, you know, I can't believe, you know, I've been friends with you for 15 years and, you know, you never told me this part of your life. So that's when he opened up to me, and that it was like for 10 days straight, he would tell me every part of his life and all the ups and downs and the good and the bad and secret operations and undercover stuff with the ATF. And then 10 days later, he gets killed, you know, in a hit and run.
Yeah, nothing surprising about that. I mean, the agency, especially from the 1950s, I mean, I guess you could consider that their inception post-OSS, but from the 50s through the, yesterday, probably, the CIA's been up to some shady shit, and they've certainly not been above hanging their people out to dry or trying to seal off loose ends. I mean, we've seen it a number of times. That is certainly why JFK is no longer with us. I mean, he may be dead anyways by now, but the agency 100% killed that guy for what they did. And that was just operators. I imagine what big agency would have done when Wild Bill Donovan was around back in the day. And there was really no congressional oversight over what they're doing. You know, it reminds me of what's that? I can't remember the name of it. What's the Tom Cruise movie that came out recently about the
American Made?
Yeah, like shit like that. It sounds stranger than fiction, but really, I would say I wouldn't say it's common. But if you talk to anybody in the industry, stuff like that is not surprising at all. Like that shit happens all the time.
Well, from my research, that is where they would cultivate, you know, special forces guys, especially after the war. That, you know, these are intelligence gathering soldiers that have been trained in that way. So that's where the CIA would do their recruiting, is they'd go over to Fort Bragg and they'd find themselves some Green Berets, some special forces guys to do some intelligence missions, come on as contractors.
Yeah. I mean, anybody that can operate as an autonomous asset is incredibly valuable to an organization, like the agency, particularly when you have language skills, right? Or when you have not necessarily specific language skills, but the ability to do business, as it were, with other countries. You learn how to be, you know, you learn when in Rome and what that really means, like how to turn a blind eye to fucking bullshit. And I'm sure in your police career, you ran into some of the same stuff. There's, if you're working any kind of intelligence or undercover operation, blending in is paramount. Otherwise, the operation's over or you get killed, right? So, you know.
Yeah, it's more than it's blending in and the bad guys 100% believe in who you are, because otherwise you're dead. You're right. You can't bullshit a bad guy and expect to walk out alive.
No, certainly not. But I mean, what some may have seen as a weakness in his physical stature, clearly Flaherty utilized this as a strength, right? I mean, absolutely, because no one out in the ether in some of the places he operated, Angola, places in Africa and stuff like that, would look at Richard Flaherty at 4'9", 4'10", whatever he was, and say like, oh, this guy's clearly an op. Like, you can see the fucking high and tight haircut, the stupid fucking special forces haircut, yeah. and the fucking aviator sunglasses. Like, oh, this guy thinks he's James Bond. Now, this guy's like tiny. Like, nobody would believe this guy's an operator. You know what I mean? He doesn't look like that.
Yeah, and that was, you know, I didn't know anything about those trips until after he was killed, and I found his passport in the storage locker. And then, you know, I found some other stuff that, you know, that he was traveling in, you know, when he was homeless from 50 to almost 70 years old. So in that time, he was traveling. He went to Venezuela twice. He went to Cambodia. He went to Iraq. He was in Amman, Jordan. And that's just the stuff on the passport, because I had another witness, a guy who was friends with him in the 70s, that him and Richard would leave the country and the State Department would have no idea. It wasn't through passports. So that could just be the tip of the iceberg. It's just one of those mysteries about the guy that he might have taken with him.
Right. Well, I mean, look, the agency owns all kinds of private companies, particularly on the East Coast, that do international cargo shipments. And they just use it as a fucking, it's their Delta Airlines. That's been going on for infinity years. Like, seriously, since planes have existed, they have been setting up cutout companies. So maybe he was traveling on a separate passport too. Who knows? I mean, it is the government who issues those things. But this is an incredible story. I mean, the guy is, I wonder, because I've read about what he did, which is impressive enough, but I always wonder why people do the things they do. I mean, people are motivated to serve for so many different reasons. A lot of the post-9/11 veterans served out of anger in a lot of ways, right? They were pissed off that their country got attacked. People that volunteered for Vietnam, and particularly where he was, I'm looking at his uniform here. I don't know if he had a Ranger tab or not, but he was at minimum a triple volunteer, which is volunteer for the military, volunteer for airborne school, volunteer for special operations. So at minimum, a triple volunteer at his stature in a war that wasn't exactly popular, right? So you have to wonder about the motivation from somebody like that. And then he continued to serve his country afterwards. Clearly, this man was just built for this shit.
Yeah, he came from a military family. Mm. Matter of fact, he has a cousin that Homer Weiss that won the Medal of Honor, and there's a big statue of him in Richard's hometown of Stamford, Connecticut. I went there to pay my respects. So he came from, his uncle served in the military. He came from a military family, and I think it's just something that he always wanted to do, is to serve his country. You know, you got to go back though in 1966, I believe, when he started applying to different military branches. Nobody would take him at 5 feet, you know, at 4'9", the height requirement was 5 feet tall. So no one would take him. He had to write waivers. He had to write letters for about 3 years until he finally obtained a waiver to get into the military.
Yeah, that's incredible. One of the things that stood out to me, and I mean, Dan, you're talking about volunteering airborne special operations, whatever, but he even, just on the little stuff, like he volunteered, this is the scariest thing to me that I've ever seen military-wise, like across anything. He was a tunnel rat.
Mm, yeah, fuck that.
Yeah.
Which fuck it, that. Although, I mean, look, if you're 4'9", you're getting voluntold to be a
well, a fucking tunnel I have a interesting, at the end of this, if you guys remind me, I got a brand new story Memorial Day. One of the guys who served with him just told me that's pretty interesting. But the tunnel rat stuff, when he first went to Vietnam with the 101st Airborne, and his first tour was right at the beginning of Tet, so they were thrown right in the middle of the shit. He didn't go into tunnels, and I talked to him about it, and he said, no, I was a lieutenant in charge of, platoon. I couldn't. You know, he wanted to go, but he couldn't do that. So he let, you know, he had other people do it for him. But when he was a lieutenant in charge of the recon unit, which was Echo Company, that's when he would go inside the tunnels himself.
Ugh, that sounds like a literal nightmare.
Yeah, I'm not in any way interested in doing that.
Well, you're a big guy. I don't think.
Uh-huh.
I believe. What did he tell you about, or what did you discover about his transition and what he did working with the CIA or ATF or whomever he was employed by?
So I would imagine his original blueprint was never to work. You know, his original blueprint in life was to be in the military for his whole life. So when, you know, he gets back from his first tour in Vietnam, then he goes to Special Forces School, then he's assigned to the 46th Special Forces Company in Thailand. And I just learned something new about those guys, because the 46 guys are very hush-hush. Like, you know, you're seeing the MACV SOG guys starting to finally, after 50 years, tell the true stories of crossing borders and stuff. Well, the 46 Special Forces Company, which is stationed in Thailand, those guys that I've interviewed have really stuck to the script. And all they'll tell you is, well, we trained the Thai Border Patrol. And then finally, I started finding one or two guys that were telling me that because they operated in what they called the pink zone, you know, them getting wounded or them getting killed would be a huge embarrassment for, you know, the Thais and for obviously the United States. And top of it's not great for your health to get shot. So, but they did go out with the Thai Border Patrol. And what they would tell me, they were fighting Malaysian and Burmese guerrillas is when they would get into firefights, who they were fighting then. So really interesting.
And he was discharged in 71 as a reduction in force. That happens.
Yeah, you know, the point I was trying to make, you just reminded me, was his original goal in life wasn't to work with the agencies or anything like that. That was to stay in the military, but it was the RIF, the reduction in force, after his second tour that, you know, officers' contracts are not renewed. So I think that at that point in time is when he initially started working as a private contractor. He went over to South Africa. He fought in the Rhodesian War as an advisor. And I think once you go down that road, that's when maybe the agency starts contacting you. And the ATF case is kind of interesting because he was training Cuban rebels in the Everglades. And my sources said that that was a CIA operation. You know, just this was, I think, 10 years after the Bay of Pigs. So he was out there training those guys, and he gets picked up by an ATF agent for possession of silencers. Richard was in possession of silencers. So the ATF back then didn't really work well with other agencies, or they, you know, I spoke to several ATF agents, and one of them was really helpful to my case, but the guy who picked up Richard, he kind of had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about special forces guys. And the first thing he said to me is, the problem with special forces guys is they think they're special. And
so he's basically Brian Dennehy then, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So
that's a Rambo reference for all you Philistines out there.
Yes, it is. So that's what he said about Richard. So he wanted to know who was funding the operation of training the Cuban rebels, and Richard, you know, no interest in talking or working. And eventually another agent, a guy named Fred Gleffy, who helped me with my investigation and to this day I'm still friends with, he's the one that started working with Richard. And Richard told him that he knew about a bunch of other Green Berets that were stealing tons of weapons and explosives out of Fort Bragg, selling them on the black market. So that's how that operation got started. And they worked for about 2 months and they recovered, I mean, it's not pounds, it's tons. They recover tons of explosives and weapons. I did find some declassified newspaper articles that were written back then that the whole operation was really a CIA operation by Richard Flaherty just to get weapons down to Central America and Honduras back then, similar to like the Iran Contra scandal.
So you've had to piece together quite a bit of this. You, from what I understand, Flaherty finally decided to start telling his story a little bit, and then within 2 weeks died in some mysterious hit and run, right? Which is odd enough. But then you were able to locate a a storage unit that he had purchased that had a lot of his stuff in it, and then began, I believe that's probably where you found his passport and some other stuff, and you started piecing all this together.
Yeah, because what happened when he started telling me his life story, I asked him, if I said, you know, I'm not sure exactly how. I think my initial thought was for me to try to find the filmmaker to pick up on Richard's story. I said, hey, can we do something? Because at that time, my initial thought was, how could this amazing soldier, this underdog, this guy who did the impossible, and then how did you become homeless? So that was my initial idea on the story. And then, you know, Richard passes, and I ended up doing it myself.
And who, I assume you've had help with this, right? I mean, my, I don't know how familiar you are with Black Rifle Coffee and those guys, but that I used to be the VP of marketing there. All my, some of my best friends, Evan, the CEO, was a former special forces operator. He was a contractor for the agency for a couple of years as well. They're working on a documentary about the Bay of Pigs right now, actually, with some of the officers that were actually involved in it, right, who are still alive now. So, you know, it's becoming, like you said, with the Mac Vsauce guys, a little more common for them to get involved to tell some of these stories and exactly what happened. I mean, look, now most of it is declassified these days. I mean, we run on pretty much a 15-year cycle unless something is is currently still a secret worth keeping, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. But, excuse me, has anybody, former agency people or former ATF people or anything like that, actually been helpful in this investigation?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I really, honestly, I think because of my law enforcement background, a lot of people opened doors for me, or I got in through doors that maybe a reporter wouldn't have been able to get into. And a lot of people felt a little bit more comfortable talking to me. So, yeah, I mean, the ATF agents, federal prosecutors have worked with me. You know, a lot of the guys that I've worked with have contacts. So I don't think I would have been able to get it through without the law enforcement background. And when you were talking about the Bay of Pigs documentary, I did interview a guy. I'm trying to think of his name. His name is Felix Rodriguez.
His name's Felix Rodriguez is the guy that put around in fucking Che Guevara's face, by the way.
Guevara. Yeah, I interviewed Felix, not with cameras or anything, but just if he worked with Richard Flaherty or if they knew each other. So a great Felix story is, you know, he lives in Miami and he invited me to his house, and it just looked like a regular house. And I had a few law enforcement friends call over to him to ask him if he would speak with me. I go into his house and I see cameras, and he's got cameras and video everywhere. I mean, Felix, you know, it looks like nothing on the outside, but on the inside, he's got everything covered. So he invites me into his house. I think he invites me for a drink, and he invites me to sit down on the couch. And there's a Glock or maybe it was a Sig. There's a 45 sitting right on the coffee table between the two couches with me and him. And I'm just wondering, like, was that there purposely to see if I'm going to reach for it or, you know, but it was interesting to do that interview. But what a great guy. What an amazing guy. Mm. What an amazing life. That is a badass motherfucker.
Did he know Flaherty at all?
No, he didn't. You know, he was familiar with some of the stuff that Richard was doing in the Everglades. But, you know, he doesn't remember. I mean, the one thing about Richard is everyone remembers if they physically saw him.
Right. Yeah.
He was so tiny, but he didn't have any, you know, idea.
How much of this, like, just whole operation between the documentary and then the book, like, you were a police officer and a detective also?
Yes.
I mean, how much of this was detective work? You said the law enforcement stuff opened doors in terms of, like, people, like, being like, okay, he's in law enforcement, I trust him. But, I mean, this seems like it was an actual detective job.
This got pretty brutal at times because Richard didn't want his, you know, people following his path. Richard didn't leave too much out there. I mean, except for the storage unit where I found stuff. You know, it wasn't just so much that Richard was a private just didn't really give any information about his life is he would also plant false stories. So there was a lot of dead ends that he would leave out there. And that was just the pattern of how he was. And maybe that was a special forces thing. And maybe that was because he worked these operations. And maybe partially the homeless thing is, besides the paranoia, besides the PTSD, is he wanted to be off the grid and make it harder for people to track him down.
Hey, David, before we continue, we have some sponsors we want to get to really quick. And the first one is Ghostbed, ghostbed.com. They're the best beds, literally, I was going to say on the internet, but on the world. And I guess that includes the internet. So both the internet and the world, Ghostbed is the best bed you can possibly buy. They're comfortable. They're versatile. They do all kinds of wild technological stuff, like all kinds of shit. I mean, they've got cooling pillows, everything. Like if you live in Texas like me, it's literally the best thing. The AC can't get cranked high enough. It's all about the cooling stuff, as well as they're just, comfortable in general. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros and use the code drinking bros to get 30% off everything. Mattresses, their adjustable base. That's right. You can make it like a hospital bed. And if you just never want to get out of bed, which I don't blame you, you can just sit there all day in front of your TV. Never leave your ghost bed. And that code also works for pillows and pretty much everything. And their pillows are cool too. Actually, you can take like stuffing in and out. If it's like, if you want like a extra fluffy pillow, I guess, you can put more stuffing in. If you like your pillow a little, I don't even know what the word would be, but you could take stuffing out. It's all you. I mean, like you can adjust anything. That's why ghost bed is the best. They also have discounts for first responders, military, police, nurses. I think maybe doctors too, not that they need it. But, just anyone on the front lines for the country, for COVID, that's when they added nurses and stuff like that, and teachers, I believe, as well. You can check it out at ghostbed.com. And again, ghostbed.com/drinkingbros with the code drinkingbros gets you 30% off everything on their site. Plus, there's a 101-night sleep trial, and their mattresses are made in the USA. It really doesn't get better than Ghostbed for their mattress. Next up, we've got Roman. I don't know what to tell you about it other than Roman is one of the best just sort of ways to deal with any male problems you may be having. Squeaky doors, clogged sinks, finicky engines. When things break around the house, you take care of it. However, when something's off in the bedroom, you kind of just try not to think about it. You tell God that he's a bastard, and then you forget it forever. But then it happens again the next time you're in the bedroom. So what are you waiting for? Take care of it. Don't just act like it's your wife's problem. It's your problem. It's your dick. So go to roman.com/drinkingbros now. I mean, with Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for erectile dysfunction and all the comfort from, the privacy of your home with all the comfort that comes with that. You don't have to go to a doctor's office, which is a huge thing. Like, you don't want to tell your doctor that. You don't want to, like, look at your doctor and be like, hey, it happened. Finally happened. It's not working. A U.S. licensed healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, they'll do that, and it ships free with two-day shipping and discreet packaging. The whole process is straightforward and discreet. So again, you don't have to broadcast that you got a little problem with your dangle. Not that there's anything wrong with that, really. It happens to the best of us. We're all only human after all, but getting started is simple. Just go to roman.com/drinkingbros and complete an online visit. Take care of your ED without leaving your home. Complete an online visit today to connect with the healthcare professional and take care of it. Get to roman.com/drinkingbros. Now you'll get $15 off your first month. It's time to take care of your ED. And remember, get started today, and you'll save $15 on your first order of ED treatment. That, one more time, roman.com, or getroman.com. I'm sorry, it's two words. Getroman.com/drinkingbros. And at any point, at what point did this become, did it ever take over where you were kind of like, it's not even just about Richard's story. Like, I want to find this out because this guy is such a mystery.
Obviously the investigator in me always wants to solve a case and close a case out. So yeah, it would drive me crazy at night when I couldn't, figure something out. Like there's so many mysteries. Like he went in the 2000s, he went to North Dakota two times in the middle of winter on the same exact dates, but just like 3 years apart. and stayed at the same hotel. And man, I dug and I dug and I dug. And, you know, I didn't physically go up there, but I really put a lot of effort into solving that and figuring out what he was doing there, and nothing.
I've got a theory. I've got a theory for you. You said it was the same exact date.
Yes.
Now, what happens once a year for pretty much everybody?
Birthday.
There you go. Birthday, anniversary. He had somebody down there for sure, right? That's the only reason somebody would do something like that on the same day. Like an operator, an intelligence operator, would never perform an operation on the same day, stay in the same hotel ever. That would never be a thing. Just from my experience working in intelligence and working in the military, there maybe he's a kid down there. Maybe there's a girlfriend, maybe something like that. Probably. That's what I would guess.
Yeah, very well could be. And that's, you know, because my initial thought was, oh, maybe there's a gun show going on, or maybe there's some sort of military thing. You know, North Dakota does have a lot of military bases, but I didn't find anything on those dates that was really significant. So your guess is probably better than mine.
What are some of the just most, I mean, because this guy has done a lot, and both in Vietnam and then in the service afterwards. Mm-hmm. What are just some of the most eyebrow raising kind of wild things you discovered?
Well, I mean, he was in the Tet Offensive. It doesn't get much more fucked up than that.
Right.
Right. I mean, because not only was it a particularly brutal series of attacks, but no one saw that coming. That's basically like being attacked by Israel on Yom Kippur, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's fucked up. Like, it's not fucked up. It's just like, how could this possibly have happened? Right. You know what I mean? But yeah, I'm sure he has some amazing stories from the Tunnel Rat days, especially, or from Special Forces of Vietnam or later. So I'd love to hear some of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at his Silver Star, I have his commendation. That was a pretty brutal fight where they took on a bunker that was chewing up their platoon, and Richard himself ran out into the middle of the fire to draw fire to him. And then he was able from there to direct a 90 millimeter, something I've never heard of, recoilless rifle. I had to look it up, and it looks like a bazooka to take out that bunker. So there's another time where Richard actually, three of his guys were lost and behind the lines, and he put on the smallest NVA uniform he could find to sneak around in the back there and try to locate, and he eventually did. He did the same. I didn't put it in the book, but he did the same move with the NVA outfit in the guarding a cache of American weapons. Something happened that they had to pull out, and they couldn't get all their weapons out in time. So Richard stayed behind dressed as an NVA soldier until I guess they can bring in some explosives.
That's really
to take those out.
I was waiting for with the possibility of the NVA showing up, and he's just going to be like, "Hey guys,
wave to them." So I know he's. Well, I mean, his size.
Yeah, he was closer to their size than ours, to be fair. Yeah. But yeah, having a guy that's that size carrying a Carl Gustav around. Carl Gustav is about 44 inches long.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so 5 feet is how many inches?
60.
There we go.
Yeah.
So he's like 4 foot. Right. And he's 4'9".
Yeah.
So it comes up to about here on him.
God.
If it's on the ground, and this motherfucker's carrying it around. Pretty impressive. I mean, it is recoilless, I guess. So that he had that going for him, but humping that thing around is not exactly great. And the dressing in the enemy's uniform, that's pretty fucking funny.
That's rad. Yeah. I enjoy that a lot. I also, I mean, in some of the documentary I was watching, his airborne training seemed pretty brutal as well, considering his size.
Yeah, airborne school back in the day. So now we do it in in PTs and tennis shoes, right?
Yeah.
But back then they did it in jump boots. Now jump boots, I don't know if you've ever seen them before, but they fucking suck. We only wear them whatever that fucking word is now, because they suck. It's like a leather shoe with the hardest sole of all time.
Is that like the Band of Brothers? What, yes. They're wearing that? Okay.
Yeah, jump boots. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. They did the entire thing in jump boots and green socks, which sucks. And for a guy that size, I mean, the benefits is that he falls so slow compared to me. Like for me, it's, I get out of the aircraft, count to four, look up, make sure my canopy is all good, grab my risers, make sure there's no jumpers below me because the lower jumpers got the right of way. You don't want to steal somebody's air. You get the fuck out of the way, find a spot. By that time, I'm like this close to the ground. Especially if I've got a ruck between my legs. It fucking sucked. But this asshole fucking, it took him like 30 minutes to drop. And it was just like a feather.
Well, they would have to strap machine gun parts to his legs because he would float off. I mean, his weight.
If you were doing a combat jump, you could. There's no way you would be able to take that. Like, seriously, some of those guys take 13 to 15 seconds to get to the ground.
Yeah.
It's way too long.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you know this, but there's no rules in war. And you can shoot people out of the air.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I had heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they were saying he in your documentary that there were rucks that were as heavy as he was.
My standard ruck was heavier than him. I mean, I carried, especially when I was an RTO, I would have like 120 to 140 pound ruck.
Yeah.
Right.
That's insane.
I mean, he was a lieutenant, which means he had an RTO, like a radio operator, with him, but he still carried more, or a lieutenant or to a captain during his time in the service. So he would have been carrying probably 100 pounds, 80 to 100 pound ruck. Yeah.
He was also. I know most lieutenants that I spoke with from back then didn't carry the M72, but for some reason the law, he would carry that around with him. I don't know why. Maybe he just liked blowing things up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we all like blowing stuff up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's shit. That's the funnest part of the job, to be honest. But that's really impressive for a guy that size. I've served with people that are smaller in stature, but I don't think anybody. The shortest dude I ever saw, and he was a shitbag. He was like 5'2", I think. We had to kick him out because he was just such a piece of shit. But I don't know how you do it at that size. People have this because of movies, because of Rambo and shit. Now, Special Forces guys are definitely in very good shape, but they're not all like 6'3" hulks. Most of them, most special operators that I know. Like the vast majority are somewhere between 5'8" and 6', right? Yeah. At the highest, 6'. Now you see people that are taller than that and that are Green Berets and stuff, but you rarely see bigger than that in like DevGru or in Delta Force, right? You just don't see it because they're endurance athletes. And the bigger you are, the harder it is to do that stuff. So I'm sure there's some of this stuff actually worked to his advantage, especially being able to get into tight spots. It's really interesting to think about.
He also, you know, I asked him if he was, you know, I mean, I would be afraid to be walking in the jungle in Vietnam. I said, were you ever afraid? And he said, no, not really. He just thought his size was a huge advantage. It'd be harder to shoot him. Maybe they'd hesitate and think that he was one of them. he said something, I don't know what an aiming stake is, or, you know, he said something about that they would always aim their weapons high anyways. And he was pretty cool with it.
Well, I guess that's an advantage because the gun goes up, right? As you fire.
Up and to the right, typically, yeah. Well, if you're a right-handed shooter, it's probably good to be smaller, be a smaller target.
Yeah,
like when you're if I'm shooting and maneuvering through a course or something like that, not in a house, you stay upright most of the time. But if you're out looking for cover, there's different ways to kneel that minimize the amount of surface area you have on purpose. Like you make yourself a blade almost.
Right? Yeah,
so it's harder to hit you. That probably was a little bit easier for him, right? Like, you remember that scene from Band of Brothers where, Lieutenant Dyke, not Dyke, he's the one that went crazy. What was his name? The guy that ran all the way across.
Spears,
yeah. Ronald Spears. True story, by the way, that really happened.
Oh, yeah.
I've read the citation for that. It's bananas. Bananas. But yeah, something like that. He'd probably be good at that.
Yeah.
Running out there, and they can't tell if it's one of their guys or one of his. These days, you might get canceled for it if he was wearing brown face or some shit, or yellow. I don't know what it's called.
I think even just putting on the uniform is...
Well,
you know, that's a really interesting thing because, you know, I did get some people that were upset. That's a war crime. They wrote me, you know, there's a lot to listen. Richard was pretty tough on the enemy. A lot of the guys said... he was pretty tough on the enemy when Richard would go on a mission. He really didn't take prisoners. I'm not going to judge, you know. I understand if you're in a situation where it's safe to get a helicopter or to get prisoners out, but that was a reoccurring theme that Richard wouldn't risk his men to really take prisoners unless it was, you know, an intelligence thing. but as far as wearing the uniforms of the NVA, I did get some pushback on that. Not that I give a fuck.
Yeah.
But, people well, upset. I mean, it is. That's a war crime and everything. Yeah. So the little story I was going to tell you guys from, I got a call Memorial Day from a guy who served with Richard in recon. His name's Al Dove, and he's in this one picture that I've posted before on social media, but I've never noticed it. And Al said, do you notice the belts me and Richard are wearing in there? And I did for the first time. And he said, well, the story about that is that we were crossing a rice paddy and there was a huge storm. I think it was Hurricane Bess came. And within like 20 minutes, the rice paddy got so deep. Al was 6'1". It was up to his neck. Richard was drowning. And would have drowned in the right, you know, can you imagine all the places in the world to drown in a rice paddy?
Well, fuck that.
So Richard with his equipment on, you know, he took one step and he fell maybe a foot or two and he was completely underwater. And I guess, you know, it's pitch black. Richard told me he was pretty sure he was a goner, but he felt a hand reach up, you know, in this dark water and pull him out. He couldn't get his equipment off fast enough to get a breath. So the rest of the walk, Al Dove, this guy Al, had to carry Richard on his back, sort of. Al kind of said it's sort of like a Yoda thing. And they made it to this little tiny island. And on this little tiny island, there were two VC taking they weren't sure if they were VC or NVA taking refuge too from the storm, because it was the only dry ground and probably a couple hundred yards. So Al shot one of the guy. The other guy tried to run, and Al hit him with an M79 round.
Oh, shit. And M79 is a 40-millimeter grenade, by the way.
Okay.
M79 Tiger. It's like an M203 or an M302 now. With the R320 with the HK version, but yeah, it's just a little bit smaller than that
wine bottle.
Yeah,
so that guy disappeared.
Actually, it's about this is just about 40 millimeters right here. Yeah. So yeah, I mean it depends. It takes time to arm. Sometimes it won't arm, and it'll just like thump like that kid Scott Olson maybe in Oakland during the Occupy Wall Street rallies. He's a former Marine that got hit in the head with one of those things. It was a smoke grenade or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. It's whether it exploded or not, that dude got fucked up is what I'm saying. Yeah. That's all I'm saying about that.
So the first guy that Al shot, you know, that was KIA immediately, ended up being an NVA captain. And on him, he had maps and everything of one of the U.S. bases in the area, and they were planning an attack. The other guy was his attaché. So it was such a huge score. You know, here the recon is just going through a little rice paddy, and you don't think much of it. And this huge score of intel and maybe preventing an attack on an American base. So in the picture that I've never noticed before, Al Dove is wearing the NVA captain's belt and Richard's wearing the attaché guy's belt. And I was like, wow, I never, you know, and it's just an amazing story. The other crazy part of that story was after they killed the two enemy, the NVAs, they literally got assaulted by rats and snakes. So, you know, as the water keeps rising, that's the only dry land. And Al said it was down to about 10 yards by 10 yards of a little land, and these giant rats started coming at them, and then cobras and other things. So they got into a firefight with snakes and rats after their first firefight. So a pretty crazy story.
Yeah, that just confirms my long-held belief that Asia is by far the worst continent to go to war on.
Yeah, probably.
That sounds like a fucking nightmare. I'd like, bring the NVA back. Like, fuck. I don't want to shit.
Yeah, I mean, imagine you're in a firefight with rats and snakes?
Fucking cobra. First off, I'd be like, go eat each other first, you rats and snakes, and then we'll deal with the winner.
You got to get a mongoose on board.
Yeah, pretty much.
Good. I don't know who, I mean, like the snake eats the rat, the mongoose eats the snake, and then I don't know what you do with mongoose, I believe is how you say that, probably, yes. Right? It's probably mongoose.
Mongoose, yeah.
I have no idea.
Mongai, maybe.
Mongai, yeah.
It's another valid one. So those are Vietnam stories. Was there anything from his time afterwards that you were like, whoa, you were doing that? Like any crazy stories just, from that time in his life that you discovered or that he told you?
You're talking about when he was with the 46 or the undercover stuff?
Either the undercover and just after post Vietnam, essentially when he was working.
So what happened was after, like I said, after we did the documentary, there were some open spots in the documentary that I wouldn't speculate on anything. I wanted that thing to be solid, and there was no speculation. So the things I wasn't sure about, I left open. But after the documentary, like I said, people came out and talked to me about things. And one guy was a guy that spent a lot of time with Richard and that went to Rhodesia with him. So there was this one, Richard, they were mostly advisors. They were just training the Rhodesian army. They weren't going out on missions with him, but there was a farm that they used to go by and talk to the landowners. And I think that night after Richard's little platoon stopped by there, that all those people were killed by rebels. And Richard and two other American soldiers, that they would call themselves Crippled Eagles. That was like a nickname, because a lot of those guys who were kicked out of the military, the reduction in force, went to Rhodesia to fight. They kind of felt a little bit betrayed by the American government, and they nicknamed themselves the Crippled Eagles. So Richard and these two Crippled Eagles went after the guerrillas that killed those landowners, the farm owners. And it's a pretty crazy story that the guy said that Richard, the first two Crippled Eagle guys who weren't special forces, they were just more infantry guys, they wanted to immediately hit the camp once they found it. And I think there was maybe 15 guerrillas on there. Richard made them wait, and he poisoned their water sauce with dead animals and animal shit to really incapacitate them. And then Richard crawled in, and he crawled into their camp, and he laid in a pool of their like latrine, a pool of shit, before they started the attack. So that's pretty out there, man. But Richard, you know, was very patient. I guess that's his special forces training.
That exceeded expectations.
That's pretty wild. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of things. That
he had what happened. Richard had a, I would have to look at my documentation, the type of silencer. He had some type of pistol. It was like a .22 silencer.
It's probably a Walther integrated silencer or integrated suppressor.
So it was so weak that Richard needed to be super close to whoever he was shooting. So that's why he laid in the pool of shit for like 6 hours until they came to use the bathroom. That was their little latrine, and he would pop them in the head. I think one of the guys that he shot, and then he dragged them into the muck with him. And then one of the guys he shot, I think it was a neck shot, or he missed his head and got him in the neck. And that guy kind of gave out the alarm. But the other two American soldiers, they were carrying, I believe, Belgian FALs or something, FLAs.
FAL, yeah.
Type of FAL, yeah. And that they just ground up those guys because they were in a higher ground, and they were able to just ground up those guys, and it wasn't even a fight.
That is incredible. Yeah. And did he? So he went to Rhodesia on his own, though.
Rhodesia, by the way, for those in the audience that don't know, is currently called Zimbabwe.
Ah,
so yeah. That's why if you're looking for it on a map, you're not going to find it. Rhodesia was like a Dutch settlement,
right?
And then maybe you've seen what's that fucking Blood Diamond. That's where Leo was fighting before Blood Diamond. Like, that's his backstory.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, but there's a... I would love to hear... I mean, I would love to know about some of the stuff that happened. Rhodesia, Angola, places like that. Because there was a lot of weird stuff going on. A lot of the governments had begun the process of moving some of the colonizers, if you want to call them that, out. But the family farms were still being protected by private military that was contracted by the government, right, of Zimbabwe. Even after Rhodesia lost the war and Zimbabwe became a thing, the government of Zimbabwe was still paying government contractors to protect these families' farms because warlords and rebels would come in all the time, try to fuck them up and kidnap them and shit. So I'm sure he had something going on like that over there, if not working directly for the U.S. government.
Yeah, listen, I'm not the biggest, I didn't pay attention that much in history, but when I started looking into more Rhodesia, I didn't know that Russia and China were in Africa at the time, and they were training the rebels and the guerrillas in the same tactics that Richard saw in Vietnam. Matter of fact, the guy that gave me all this information said there was even Cuban generals there training these Rhodesian guerrillas to attack the forces. So maybe in Richard's mind, you know, he was still fighting communism. Maybe a lot of those guys' minds, they were there to continue their fight against communism.
Right. I mean, that was part of, Richard was around during detente, right? So there's three stages of the Cold War. The first was containment, where we fought all these micro wars. Anywhere we could find Russian influence, we would try to go down there and disrupt the economy and create rebels or whatever the case is. Then Kissinger came along, and there was a period of détente, which means relaxation, essentially. So the public face of the Cold War was like, hey, we're just going to take it easy. But in reality, they were still fucking each other up behind the scenes all over the place.
Right.
And these little wars like this would be categorized in the media, if they even made it to the media, as something completely different. Like, oh, it's a war of Zimbabwe and independence, or it's this or it's that. In reality, it was for sure Russian and Chinese influence being battled by American special operators for fucking years.
Actually, one of the most famous battles in Cuban history is against the South Africans in Africa. I forget the name of it, but that's like a very celebrated in Cuba battle. They were like,
South African Border War. That's called, it's officially called the South African Border War, the Battle of Quito Carnival. And it was in Angola. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, what the fuck was Cuba doing there?
Right.
Yeah.
And we're not taught that in schools. We don't really know that much about it. And the same thing, the stuff in Central America with the spread of communism and influence from other countries. These hidden wars, these secret wars are going on to this day. And, you know, there are, you know, thank God we do have, you know, intelligence and CIA and working on our side in the shadows. Thank God, in some aspects.
Yeah, in some. Well, I mean, look, you can't really question the heart of the American warfighter, but the American politician leaves a lot to be desired.
100%, man. Absolutely.
And you probably know that as a cop as well. I mean, shit. When did you retire? What year did you retire?
Well, they retired me 3 years ago. I just had to have my second back surgery, so. As I was getting closer to my first back surgery, they had to fuse my spine. They were like, you know, maybe it's time for you to wrap this thing up and go. Yeah. So I retired. They retired me 3 years ago.
But you had like 30 years in, 20 right? years. Oh, you did 20 years. You said you did 20? Yeah. Okay. So what were you doing at the end?
Well, at the end, they had me on a desk. I was doing background investigations. So I was just you know, I was a street guy. I love working the street. I like to be out there doing it. So, you know, listen, life is what it is.
Oh, yeah.
It happens in chapters. you got to accept it. So I'm just moving to that next chapter and not looking back.
I hear you.
Speaking of that, what was it like? I mean, being... I believe a first time or relatively close to first time filmmaker doing this. I mean, I know you do have actually a couple credits on your IMDb page and stuff like that, but
that, you know what? Thank God I didn't know how much work it was going to be. Otherwise I never would have did it. So I was so ignorant and I was so like, you know, oh, how hard can this be? But it's, I mean, if you give a shit, it's hard. And I guess if you don't, you could just put out garbage. But
right.
I wanted to do the best I could. I wanted to tell Richard's story in a way that would honor him and the men that served with him, the men of the 101st Airborne and the 46th Special Forces Company. Those guys all trusted me with their stories, with their, you know, with their legacies. So I couldn't fuck that up. And that was a lot of pressure. And I also did make a promise to Richard before he passed that if I started the project, I would finish it and see it to the end. So, it was really a lot harder than I thought.
And then was the book, how about that? First time author, I assume.
Well, you know, the easy part of the book, not the easy, but you know, the starting out as a police officer and then eventually becoming a detective, we're writing all the time, writing narratives. We're describing a story. We're, you know, so it's something that you do every day as a police officer. You're writing some sort of offense incident report or some sort. So I just kind of followed those same steps of, you know, telling the story from the beginning to the end for the anyone reading it.
Fair enough. That's cool. Where can people find the book and the documentary? What where should they look for? Where should they buy it?
Yeah, to make it easy on everyone, obviously Amazon, you can get the paperback audiobook or ebook, and Amazon also offers the film on Prime for free. It's called The Giant Killer, Finding Flaherty. But, you know, some of the people like the streaming, the new streaming services. So we're on Tubi, we're on Vudu, even YouTube. If you want to rent it on YouTube, you can watch it there. So try to make it easy on people. Social media, I try to post new stuff, and also that's where I get, you know, new people contacting me with Flaherty stories. So I have a Facebook page for them called the Giant Killer. And, you know, anyone who has new stories, you'll see sometimes I'll add there, hey, I went to OCS with Flaherty. Hey, I was in Basic with Flaherty, or, you know, I just actually hooked up these two doctors, medics, that haven't spoken to each other in 40 years. And one guy saw one of my posts and said, hey, you know, I know this, you know, Doc Bishop, I know this guy. And I was able to give, you know, have these guys exchange emails. So, God, man, those Vietnam veterans, they got shit on. Every one of them has a heart wrenching story of what it was like when they got home from Vietnam. I hope this helps a little bit.
Yeah, so I was going to ask next is, what do you kind of just hope to get out of all of this, the documentary, obviously, and the book and stuff as well?
You know, it started out as Richard's story, but then it kind of became all these Vietnam vet stories. And I'm hoping, you know, a lot of them do talk about their PTSD, and some of the things that I thought I learned about it is, you know, early intervention, the thing I now call the three Fs, family, faith, and friendship. Super important for those guys that came back from Vietnam that had families, or they had strong religious beliefs, or they really had a powerful friendship network. They were able to somehow keep that train on the tracks while, you know, guys like Flaherty kind of without that float off. Because all those guys, every one of those guys said the same thing to me, that they just want to be left alone. They just wanted to walk off into the woods, and some were able to, and some, you know, because of their responsibilities, they didn't, and kind of kept them a little bit grounded.
Awesome. I mean, that's it's great.
Yeah, it is amazing. Amazing story. I'm looking forward to watching the doc. And for those of you who are going to ask, I'm sure you would. The book is also available on Audible if you're an audiobook person. Yeah. It's available pretty much everywhere. So that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get out there and watch it. This is a pretty incredible story. We appreciate you coming on today and talking about this stuff. I'm going to get into this and read about this stuff a little bit, and we might reach back out to you and do another one of these, and bring out some of the other guys we know that have been involved in this, or at least hook you up with them so you can talk with them too. Cause a lot of these guys share similar stories.
Man, that would be such an honor and a privilege. I mean, people have always asked me, like, you know, don't you think Richard was lucky that he met you at the end? And I was like, absolutely not. It's the other way around. I'm beyond honored and privileged to have met Richard, and that he told me a story. And this has been an incredible journey. So I'm very honored.
Well, yeah. And thanks for coming on. I love that the story's just like still unfolding.
Dude. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, you're basically Nicolas Cage right now.
It never ends, yeah. Man. It never ends.
Yeah. You're going to have to, you're more than likely might be writing a sequel,
at least an addendum. Yeah.
Yeah. For real, to The Giant Killer. But hey, David, thank you so much for being on today, on Drinking Bros. For Dan Holloway, I'm Rob Fox. David Yuzik has been our incredible guest today, and his story, both in documentary and book form, The Giant Killer, available everywhere. Incredible story about Richard Flaherty, a Vietnam vet and intelligence operator after the war. Thank you so much for being on.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot.